You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
The number of people who are feared dead runs into tens of thousands. What we know is that the people who are there now, who survived this disaster, need our help. The international community is mobilizing.
The words there of Francis Kennedy, spokesperson for the World Food Program, working as part of the effort to assist the Philippines in the wake of Typhoon Haiyan. We will have reports from the islands. The staging areas for the relief efforts are being organized and stocked up. Distribution is the main challenge right now. Also this hour, a discussion of the political challenges for the civilian democracy in the Philippines. Also, a Supreme Court test of some longstanding union organizing tactics in the U.S. The debate over the farm bill on Capitol Hill becomes a debate over social policy as the food stamp program takes center stage. And we'll explore the history of America from a carnivore's perspective, the very serious side of America's meat-eating culture. But first,
the biggest challenge is assessing the needs, getting to the communities that have been affected and trying to get a sense of what their biggest needs are.
It's a spokesman for Mercy Corps, Andrea Koppel, describing the biggest challenge for rescuers and relief operations in the Philippines right now, seeing the full extent of the damage. Janice Sweeney is a spokesman for the American Red Cross, talking about the additional difficulties in communications after the devastation of the typhoon.
We sent two of our specialists in telecommunications along with a satellite system to help with that issue. They can pop up our satellite communication system and be able to provide phone lines and computer lines so that they can help, you know, bring that communication piece back together.
We'll see how much that assists the devastated infrastructure in the Philippines. In one of the staging areas for relief operations, relatively intact Cebu City, where we spoke with New York Times reporter Austin Ramsey.
Haiyan sort of plowed through the midsection of the islands. And so there are areas particularly close to where the eye of the storm passed through that were quite devastated. And Tacloban City is, of course, the one that everyone has been paying attention to the past few days.
And in terms of infrastructure, how has the weather and just the complicated geography of the Philippines made a rescue and recovery effort almost impossible?
What the storm did is it just caused a huge wall of water to crash over much of the island, and it just took out everything, homes, roads, cars, the airport. So it's all infrastructure on the island is pretty decimated.
Is Cebu City a staging point for the relief effort, or one of them?
Yes, it is. Lots of aid groups are sort of setting up here because it's the closest point in terms of flying into Tacloban. So it's also a staging point for journalists and what have you. So, you know, quite a lot of people are going from Cebu to Tacloban. Quite a lot of people are trying to get out. It's much easier to get there than to get out these days.
Reporting from Cebu City in the Philippines, New York Times reporter Austin Ramsey. Austin, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
On the line from the Philippine capital, Manila, Orla Fagan is Humanitarian Affairs Officer at the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Orla, what's the condition now some days after the worst of Typhoon Haiyan? The weather is unstable, we understand, and the relief effort is really just getting started.
It is. It's cranking up as we speak. The Americans have come in. They've brought in a Hercules. There was no transport in and out of the airport in Tacloban today, but it will all really start coming into gear. We had Valerie Amos in, the Undersecretary General and the Coordinator of Humanitarian Affairs, and she came in today to launch the appeal, which is $301 million. The Emergency Seed Fund has already been approved that the UN itself has given, and that is at $25 million. The aid is pouring in. The government today expressed gratitude for the solidarity shown by the humanitarian community and by the global community for the people of Tacloban.
In terms of delivery of services, how are we doing there?
It's still not getting in at the moment. It's the challenge. There is a severe storm heading our way again. It's nature. We're fighting nature at this stage. People are getting annoyed. They're looting. You can't blame them. They need food. They're desperate for food. We're desperate to get in. So there's frustration all around at this stage.
And in terms of government preparation, I've seen this described as a man-made and a natural disaster in the sense that because of its geography, the Philippines ought to have known the vulnerability of some of these low-lying areas.
They did, and there was 126,000 people evacuated. But it was the surge that caught everybody by surprise. Nobody expected these huge waves, tsunami-like waves, to come in. So the food that was pre-placed there, also a lot of it got swept away.
What would you say the comparison is here in the Philippines to the much more severe, at least in terms of numbers, tsunami that took place in the last decade?
You're not going to be able to make comparisons until we do a full assessment of what the damage is. So far, we're still trying to get into Eastern Samar. The only way we can get in is through motorcycle. The roads are so badly blocked. The only thing that's getting through is motorcycles. How can you deliver aid into that without, you know, a fleet of helicopters? And maybe that's what it will take to deliver aid. But I would be reluctant to actually do any big comparison on that until we know what we're dealing with. And we're still not sure what we're dealing with yet.
And it took a long time to know what we were dealing with in those disasters you mentioned. Orla Fagan is Humanitarian Affairs Officer for the United Nations Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Manila. Orla, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Philippines President Benigno Aquino III has been widely credited with turning the tide of the generations-long history of corruption in his country. But the government and civilian democracy in the Philippines is being tested by this national calamity, which the president has already declared this week. Richard Chu is an associate professor of Philippine colonial history, Pacific Empires, and Asian Pacific America at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Professor, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
So how does the special relationship between the U.S. and the Philippines both assist in the recovery effort and maybe complicate the recovery effort and the ability of the Philippines to respond?
I think I would look at the situation from a historical point of view. As most people know, the United States colonized the Philippines for about 50 years. And during that time, they created a political system, a so-called a democratic system, but they also created a system where people engage in patronage and clientelism. In other words, Filipino officials can only get elected to government positions if they have a strong backer from the American colonial government. And at the same time, economically, the U.S. colonial government created an economy that was controlled by a few families, and creating an oligarchic society, so to speak. And after 1946, when the Philippines gained independence, these few families continue to run the country, and they continue to engage in a patronage system of politics. And so they get voted to power by people who are loyal to them, whom they think would serve their best interests, but not the interests of the nation as a whole. So that is kind of a colonial legacy that the United States left. That might be seen as a disadvantage to the current culture of corruption in the Philippines. But at the same time, this special relationship is quite beneficial right now. So you can see that the United States is pouring in money and sending warships to aid in the relief efforts.
Although the infrastructure that the U.S. Invested in the Philippines was mostly military, and a lot of that has been dismantled in the years since the end of the dictatorship in the Philippines. I'm wondering if the Aquino family is one of those oligarchic families and that the clock is really ticking on the level of cynicism that the people of the Philippines will express towards the president, which could spur all kinds of political instability in the country where there's been civil war really over the last decade or so.
I think most people still see Aquino, the current president, as incorruptible. And he was certainly much better than his predecessor. or predecessors, except for his own mother, Corazon Cojuangco Aquino, who was president from 1986 to 1992. But even though he has tried to solve the issue of corruption by placing honest men or women in the government or in government positions, the culture of corruption is so embedded in our society. It is systemic, it's structural, that in order to change things, you really have to overhaul the system as well as the mindset of people. And I think for now, the people, they're so used to all these calamities and the government being corrupt and inept that I don't think it would spur or create a big tide of cynicism against the Aquino government. We've seen these disasters happen year every year, and how the government had been responding. So I would predict that after a few months, the same story happens again, that we will still be embedded in the culture of corruption.
Well, there'll be certainly time enough for that kind of cynicism against the government. For now, the immediate concern is the rescue and recovery effort in the Philippines. Richard Chu, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Richard Chu is an associate professor of Philippine colonial history, Pacific Empires, and Asian Pacific America at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. Later in the hour, food insecurity in the USA. For some of you, it has been a way of life.
Hi, this is Mickey Curry from Massapequa Park. Yes, I was raised on food stamps, welfare, and the government cheese. And being from suburbia, I found it hugely embarrassing and gave me lots of incentive to plan ahead and make sure my kids were never raised on it.
This is Mariah. Yes, we've definitely had to utilize the food shelf during the time when I was pregnant. I was on bed rest, and my husband had a job. He made $8 an hour, and that didn't get very far. Nowadays, we definitely try to donate whenever possible. It was definitely life-saving.
I didn't eat food stamps 15 years ago, and it really did help me out. I was granted 3 months of it. It helped me. I went and told them I got a job, got off of them, and went on my way.
I'm calling from Florida. My family has been with food stamps for about 3 years. Since my husband lost his job. And although I have to say that it's very complicated getting it, it's been a lifesaver for my family. And I am very grateful to have this backup when things go wrong and you need help.
Thanks to Mickey and Mariah for those stories. Two of you found a way off food stamps, only 47 million people to go. In Tacoma, Washington, as a contractor working for $11 an hour with a partner in school full time, I require food stamps. Thank God I was able to plant a food garden with EBT because it's the collards, beets, and kale that's keeping us fed through the winter. Call us with your story at 877-8MYTAKE. Be a part of the conversation at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com.
What power is appropriate, even legal, for workers to have in their attempts to unionize? That question is before the U.S. Supreme Court in the form of a challenge to so-called neutrality agreements. Employers promise not to block unionization drives in exchange for giving the union access to workers to make a case for unionization. Another case on the docket this session involves compulsory union fees. An Illinois home care worker challenged paying fees to a union she didn't support. On both cases now, we're joined by Benjamin Sachs, Harvard Law professor. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hello, it's great to be here.
Let's talk first about the neutrality agreement. I had not heard of these before, and it's hard for me to understand how this would be a Supreme Court case. Is there pressure in taking these neutrality agreements on the part of employers?
Well, you know, it's interesting you say you haven't heard of these before. The neutrality case, the organizing agreement case, is a classic sleeper case for the Supreme Court, by which I mean this is a case that seems to involve a kind of arcane provision of the labor law that nobody's heard about, that nobody's paying attention to. But the stakes actually couldn't be bigger here. Because what's at issue in this case is whether people will have any longer an effective right to organize unions in the country. And I think it would come as a shock to many people that the Supreme Court is being asked to essentially outlaw the process through which most unions get organized today. What the Supreme Court is being asked to do is to say that whenever whenever an employer grants to a union some concessions in this contracting process about the rules of organizing, that those concessions are a bribe and actually a felony under federal labor law.
Wow.
So that's what the Supreme Court is being asked to hold. You know, I for years taught this theory in my labor law class at Harvard, and I taught it as kind of a crazy, outlandish theory, because I think the truth is that for decades, while all of these things were going on, no one ever thought that they were corrupt. In fact, people thought this is entirely consistent with what unions are supposed to do, that is to say, to go out and try to organize workers. And if employers cooperated in that effort because the employers wanted to, that was fine, not corrupt. But now we have this theory before the Supreme Court. And as I said, it's really a threat to unions' ability to organize workers, because the more traditional National Labor Relations Board process simply doesn't work anymore. Mm.
Well, a potentially transformative doctrine, depending on the outcome before the court. We're talking with Benjamin Sachs, Harvard Law professor. We should note that the case here is Unite Here, Local 355 versus Mulhall, and an employee has brought this case, has brought this challenge, saying that this neutrality agreement constitutes, as you say, some sort of form of corruption. Has the Supreme Court ever ruled that in a non-union world that an employer has an unfair advantage if they're the ones who are advocating against a union, that if there's a union versus employer battle, that unless there's a neutrality agreement, the employer has some sort of advantage?
You know, I don't think there's a specific case in which the Supreme Court has said the employer has an unfair advantage. But the whole structure of our federal labor law is designed to make sure that employees have a genuinely free choice on the question of whether or not they want a union. The law is not supposed to push workers toward unionization, and it's not supposed to discourage them from unionizing. It's supposed to level the playing field, so to speak, so that workers can choose freely on this very important question. And a lot of what the law is designed to do is to prevent employer coercion of workers when they're making that choice. It's supposed to prevent union coercion of employees when they're making that choice, and employer coercion, to leave it to the workers to decide. I think the problem is the law hasn't functioned. The National Labor Relations Board is too slow and too weak to actually police these things. And so unions and employers, I think, have sensibly agreed to, by contract, create their own ground rules. It's worth saying here that in a way, Mulhall is a case on which liberals and conservatives ought to actually agree. Because in a lot of ways, what Mulhall is about freedom of contract. It's about the freedom of unions and employers to, by private contract, design their own rules for union organizing campaigns, rather than having the government design those rules, at least giving unions and employers the option to do it by private contract. And for the court to come in and say, no, it's illegal, it's actually a felony to arrange your affairs privately in this way, that's something that I think conservatives and liberals should chafe at. The other thing that's worth saying here is, you know, there's been a lot in the country over the last couple of years about unions and labor law. We've seen big fights in places like Ohio and Wisconsin. And the issues in those fights are very real and very much about the extent to which people are comfortable with unionization and how powerful we think unions ought to be. I would say this is very different than those fights, and it's very different because this is not the democratic process playing out.
Well, we'll get a glimpse of how the Supreme Court responds to that argument. Before we go, though, Harris versus Quinn about fees paid by non-union workers because of union representation in an industry. How important is this case, Harris versus Quinn?
Yeah, so this is like the 1-2 punch for the United States labor movement. So Mulhall is about private sector workers and the ability of private sector workers to effectively unionize. This case, Harris versus Quinn, is a public sector case and challenges under the First Amendment of the Constitution the permissibility of the ways that unions have collected dues from workers for decades. And the issue is whether in the private sector a union and an employer can have an agreement in a collective bargaining contract that says that if you work in the bargaining unit and you're represented by the union and you benefit from the things the union bargains, can you be required to pay some portion of the dues and fees that members pay? Nobody can ever be compelled to be a member of a union in the United States. But in order to overcome what we call a free rider problem, the law has long allowed unions to charge employees for the fees that the union provides. What Harris versus Quinn raises is whether or not that is in fact still constitutional.
Well, the Harris case will be heard this session. The Mulhall case is actually going to be heard this week. Benjamin Sachs, Harvard Law School professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, our friends at the Retro Report documentary team remind us that power outages don't need to be the result of natural disasters tearing down infrastructure. In 2003, there was a blackout that began with a simple malfunction that started a chain reaction on a perfectly calm day in August.
We are in the midst of what appears to be a colossal and history-making blackout.
People trapped in elevators and buildings. They have activated the emergency command center.
The subway system is down.
Ottawa is completely without power now.
The lightning-quick domino series of failures.
This week, more than 200 U.S. public and private large power companies are staging a mock blackout to test a system for lessons learned from a decade ago. Jonathan Gruber, Retro Report director, joins us now. Jonathan, welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on.
Describe the cascade of events that really turned this from what seemed like an East Coast phenomenon to a regional phenomenon.
Well, it was something that really should have been isolated and caught in Cleveland or outside of Cleveland, Ohio. There were a series of power lines that went down on a hot day in August, and people didn't see it. It wasn't monitored properly. Either the local power producer, First Energy, or the regional power coordinator, MISO. One system was supposed to have been upgraded. It was shut down. A fellow went to lunch, didn't turn it back on. And so things cascaded, spiraled out of control. People weren't there to see what was going on. It's really remarkable that something that really some lines that were hot on a hot August day that went into some trees could lead to something like this.
And it went down much more quickly than it was able to be brought back online again, which really reminds us that this is not just a bunch of switches on a wall somewhere that you flick them one way and the lights go off and you flick them another way and the lights go on.
Well, it's one of the amazing things about the grid is that power can be sent hundreds of miles in a matter of seconds. It also is what makes the grid so vulnerable, and that if something happens in one part of the grid, it can affect others. And one of the reasons why it is like that is the grid develops sort of organically because there's no energy storage. When you produce electricity, it's kind of a use it or lose it thing, and local providers in the early 20th century realized that if they joined up with their neighboring power suppliers, that they could share production efficiency. So if someone had extra power, they could ship it over to their neighbor where there might be more demand. It's a great system, but it certainly has its flaws as well.
Can you assess as to whether we are still vulnerable, the grid is still vulnerable to a similar kind of shutdown that starts in a small way but has a huge impact?
Things have really improved in the last 10 years in terms of monitoring the actual technical equipment that keeps track of things on the grid. Other system operators can look into their neighbor's grid system to say, is something wrong. But there's still issues, and things can still happen. Today, we have probably more of an issue of cyber terrorism than there was in 2003. There are situations overseas where power production has been shut down, and that's certainly something that could happen here. It's unclear how safe we are.
And specifically to the Ohio utility that ostensibly started all of this, are they assured that it won't ever happen again here, or could any small little utility trigger this kind of thing in the future?
No one is guaranteeing that this couldn't happen again, but people feel more confident that with these monitoring devices that they have, things called PMUs, phaser measurement units, that they feel more prepared. But I think that what happens with any of these large-scale issues is that you look back and say, oh, why didn't we catch that? Why didn't we catch that? So sure, for a blackout like 2003, we might be more prepared, but for a blackout of 2013 and beyond, it's hard to tell.
Yeah, you're always fighting the last war in the electricity grid, just like on the battlefield. Jonathan Gruber, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Jonathan Gruber is director of Retro Report. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. To Washington now, and the partisan wrangling over the farm bill, which has become a debate over social policy in America. Buried in the $500 billion farm bill is funding for food stamps, with the Republican-controlled House advocating cutting $39 billion from the program over the next 10 years, and the Democratic-controlled Senate pushing for a $4 billion cut. It's cuts all the way around. In a moment, we will discuss automatic cuts that have already been felt for the millions of food stamp recipients. But first, joining us now, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So the food stamp program is always in the farm bill, and the farm bill always becomes a debate over social policy, but there are a lot of debates in there right now. Where does it stand?
Yeah, there sure are. And, you know, just to make sure people understand how big of a deal SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps, is to the farm bill, it's not quite buried. I mean, it's most of the iceberg. The farm bill is actually 70% food stamps, and most people don't know just how big this program is. John, there are nearly 50 million Americans who use food stamps today, and that number swells, of course, when the economy is bad. That's not a surprise. Well, the farm bill has been controversial. Why? It's worth a ton of money, as you said. It's not just the food stamps debate, which is the biggest part of it, but also debates in Congress over what to do with farmers, direct payments, crop insurance, all the different monies that Washington sends to farmers via a lot of very powerful special interests, all mix into an environment that's all about cost cutting, that's about partisanship, and that has resulted in lack of agreement on the farm bill, and more importantly, a conservative Republican House that wasn't able to pass a farm bill at all because of controversy over food stamps. John, what they did over the summer and the early fall was take out the food stamp provision entirely, strip it out of the farm bill, because the conservative House couldn't get a farm bill passed at all unless they did that. And that's how they landed on that nearly $40 billion cut figure that House conservatives want to cut out of the food stamp program now. And that's why they're at such loggerheads.
Is that also why there seems to be, I mean, loggerheads, yes, I agree with you there. But in a sense, that whole deal and wheeling and dealing has produced a consensus that both Democrats and Republicans want cuts, even if they aren't agreed on the number.
Yes, they do, except a $4 billion cut, which you mentioned is the Senate figure, only one-tenth of the House figure of a $40 billion cut over 10 years. And the way you cut is critical here. First of all, it's important to note that everybody expects, hopes, will watch the economy steadily improve over the next 5 years. Not as fast as we'd like, but we all acknowledge that economies are cyclical, and this one is improving. And that means automatically less people trying to access these benefits. So when you talk about a $4 billion cut, while the Senate says we would rather not cut at all, we don't think it's draconian because less people as we go. Also, cutting, how you cut, this program, John, I got to step back, is so complicated that the way you cut, you can take 1,000 different slices at food stamps. Can you just cut benefits? Say, hey, you used to get $100, now you get $50. Sure, you can do that. Democrats like Senator Debbie Stabenow, who's chairman of the Agriculture Committee, says she's not going to do that. So what else can you do? You can have income tests. You can have asset tests. You can do what some states are doing by saying, hey, pay, you still get your money. But anybody who's a childless adult who's able-bodied, you don't get food stamps at all, or you get them only for a very limited time. And every state has a different rule, so that's why it's so complicated.
So you can mess with the eligibility. Now, economists have noted that the food stamp program, because it is so ubiquitous, 47 million people, almost 50 million, as you say, in the program, it is an almost instantaneous stimulator to the economy. And when there are cutbacks, it has almost instantaneous effects in terms of the numbers of people who basically have to revert to other sources for food, right?
Because people spend the money right away. Look, nobody's taking food stamps and banking them. You can't. And nobody's saving it up for a TV. No. They're spending this money right away. But remember, when you talk about stimulus, John, Washington is done with stimulus. Conservatives in particular are done with stimulus. The only stimulus they want to pass is tax cuts. And even some of those are not in the offing in budget talks. So that's really where they stand. A massive gap. And they have until Thanksgiving to solve it.
Stimulus done. That means the economy is okay. Is that the verdict? Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
Pleasure, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
From Washington politics to the real deal. Tax cuts get debated in America, so do debt limits, but the largest cut for the food stamp program in its nearly 50-year history, oh, you didn't hear about it, happens without a whimper, without a protest. It's an automatic cut. In fact, the 2009 stimulus bill in the middle of the recession added billions to the monthly food stamp allotment on a temporary basis, but it expired at the end of October, affecting millions of people, most of them children, in every state. Just another slash to the budget, a glaring line item adding to, in fact making worse, the record income inequality that the U.S. economy manages to so masterfully ignore. So, Rafaela Rivera, welcome.
Hello.
The recession is over, I guess. You don't need food stamps anymore?
I guess not.
I see. So what was the impact for you on November 1st?
It did affect us a lot. We usually, like, let's say, for instance, milk, we would buy 3 gallons of milk throughout the whole month that, you know, as we needed it. But now it's probably going to be maybe a gallon and a half. So even cereal is expensive. It's almost $7 a box. So we would get cereal for each, you know, for the kids and which one they enjoyed. But now it's like we have to get one where everybody can enjoy it and, you know, be good with the cereal that they
share and share alike. Now, the economists tell us that the economy is improving, that the recession is over, that growth is back in the U.S. economy. But in terms of your situation for your family, has anything changed since 2009?
No. Nope.
Describe your situation. You've got how many kids?
I have 2 children, 9 and 6-year-old. And I know what my parents went through as I was growing up, when we would be like, okay, well, we want this. And then you got to be like, no, you can't get this because we got to figure out what we're going to get for dinner or what you can get for snacks.
What's your employment situation? And you live here in New York?
I live in New York. I was working as a home health aide, but I got laid off. My patient's case was closed or finished with her insurance, so they weren't going to be able to pay her services.
An insurance situation. There's another issue that relates to what's going on in Washington. Chris Bean is also with us, executive director of the Part of the Solution Food Pantry right here in the Bronx. Chris, how typical is Rafaela's story based on what you're seeing since the end of October?
I think Rafaela's story is really consistent with a lot of what we've seen. So Part of the Solution POTS probably sees about 20,000 people in 2013, which is a big number. But that number has consistently grown all through the recession with the stimulus that was a tremendous help, I guess you would say, to be able to increase SNAP. But over just the last 2 weeks, we've already seen probably another 100, 110 people who have come in and explicitly said, I am here this week because of the cut in SNAP.
Let's separate the safety nets here. The food stamp program would have had an impact on families that normally wouldn't come to your food pantry, right?
Correct. I mean,
once that cut goes into effect, then all of a sudden you start seeing faces.
Correct.
And you know, maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. Well, you're the next safety net. The federal government can't pay.
And what's amazing, I think, is we really take pride in the fact that we're able to help individuals who need that extra help, need something where food insecure, need those couple extra meals. But at the end of the day, when we look at, we serve, let's say, 750,000 meals a year, which is a huge number.
It's huge.
If you look at the amount in this cut of the amount of meals it would go just in New York State, it's 195 million meals. So I take a lot of pride in the incredible work that POTS does and groups like POTS does. But in terms of the sheer volume, 750,000 meals versus 195 million. And what is difficult is for a lot of people, you look at the numbers that are cut, $11, $20, $36, doesn't seem like a big number. But when it's a real life, a real person, that's 2 days worth of food. And again, that may not seem like a lot, but you try having that conversation with your kids at the end of the month that the 29th to 30th, we're not going to have dinner tonight.
All right. The economists say, as I was mentioning to Rafaela here, that the recession is over, that part of the reason this expired is because we're out of the woods right now. I don't imagine there's a lot of balloons up at your facility going, recession over, welcome back to the food pantry.
We have not had that party just yet.
Well, what are people saying? How do they respond to this? I mean, this is something that we're supposed to be moving away from, but the trend lines are down for you.
What I think a lot of people, one, would be frustrated, but secondly, at the end of the day, Rafael and other individuals can speak to it, just you have to find a way to make ends meet,
yeah.
Whether it's going to various pantries, relying on family members. It's obviously frustrating, but at the end of the day, you've got to make sure that you're able to put food on the table for your children.
Do you feel farther behind today than you did in 2009, Rafaela?
Yes. Even as when I was working, it was still kind of hard for us to, you know, because my husband's disabled, so he can't really go out and work. So it's just whatever. Now it's less because I'm not working that, you know, it's just we got to depend on his money and stretch the little bit of money that we have for the kids.
So what are your options? Are you relying on Chris's food pantry?
Oh, yeah, they've helped us out a lot. They give us fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, grains, noodles, spaghetti stuff. That's, you know, the easiest stuff that we can make real quick for the kids that they'll enjoy, spaghetti.
Well, recession not over, and as we head into the holiday period, food insecurity is terrifying for families. It's certainly overwhelming for social service organizations such as yourself. Chris Bean, thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Chris Bean is executive director of the Part of the Solution Food Pantry in the Bronx right here in New York. And Rafaela Rivera, what's next for you?
Just look forward.
Back uptown.
Yep.
And see how we're going to make ends meet.
Yes,
Rafaela,
sir.
Thanks so much for
Thank
coming
you.
To the studio.
Thank you for having us.
We're going to leave you with two voices of our listeners who've also had an experience with the food stamp program.
Hey, this is Stu in Seattle, and I've used food stamps a handful of times, and I currently utilize my neighborhood food banks, even though technically under the law I'm employed full-time. 30 hours weekly is not full-time. Of course, do things like stretch mac and cheese with whatever is canned and on the shelf.
Hi, this is Melissa in New Jersey. After losing my job as a financial advisor with a large firm, I found myself with food insecurity. Before that, I had donated food often to food banks. It got so bad, I ultimately filed for food stamps. I no longer need food benefits, yet the experience has certainly humbled me.
If you've been humbled by food insecurity this time of year or any other, we'd love to hear your story. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and there's much more at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And his coat was made of good roast beef, of good roast beef, of good roast beef.
Here's one more thought about food.
Breakfast in bed. Bacon and egg.
You want me to hold the chicken, huh?
I want you to hold it between your knees.
It's big. It's beefy.
The idea of meat, it kind of gets in your head early in America.
Equality is the prime rib of America.
That's a spicy meatball.
Hamburgers. The cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast.
burgers, chicken, pork, fish, the U.S. Department of Agriculture says 2 to 3 ounces, maybe twice or three times a day, is a nutritious diet. How we got here, from the hunters of early America chasing pheasant around the woods to the planetary-scale agribusiness of today and the mythology of Samuel L. Jackson's pulp fictional burger breakfast, is the subject of the new book In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America, written by Iowa-based historian and former vegetarian Maureen Ogle. And yes, we are a carnivore America. Maureen Ogle, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
One of the things that surprises, but it shouldn't really surprise us, I guess it's more of a reminder, is that when Europeans arrived in North America, they instantly saw a place with unlimited land and unlimited stocks of fish and game. And because of the agricultural history of Europe, immediately these European settlers went about going, oh, look at all of this being wasted here. They completely saw a different land than the natives who were here.
That's right. One of the most remarkable things about the settlement of what eventually became the U.S. is that the people who settled it, wherever they came from and whatever condition they came from places of chronic scarcity. And the abundance here, it was just psychologically stunning to people. They went from a world where scarcity was norm to the realization that abundance could be theirs. And what they chose to create an abundance of was meat of all kinds.
And a cow and a calf in the currency of the early 1800s, maybe late 1700s, would equal a quarter of an entire year's harvest of tobacco.
That's right. And without anywhere near the labor and stress. That's right. So, you know, take your pick. What are you going to go for? What Americans went for was livestock and meat. And meat was so abundant that people who visited the colonies and then later the United States simply couldn't believe what they were seeing. It was just unthinkable to a European that anyone would have access to meat and as much meat and as often as Americans did.
Were the growing expectations of an urban American population of having meat whenever they wanted it at a price that they could afford, were those expectations what made agribusiness and the sort of collectivized sort of hugeness of the meat production business inevitable in America?
What I discovered and what honestly surprised me was how much of the innovation that we point to now as being corporate driven was in fact devised, invented, developed, and embraced by family farmers who struggled constantly to figure out how to meet the demands of an extremely demanding urban public who thought nothing of staging protests, boycotts, trashing butcher shops when they thought the price of meat was too high. I think another way to look at it is that what family farmers were capable of producing simply wasn't enough, given that the majority of Americans chose not to live on a farm. I think the story is so complicated that just to assume that it's the relentless search for corporate profits and big food and big ag to blame for everything is just entirely too simplistic.
I'm interested, after all this 7 years of research that you've done, in what you might make of a book like Upton Sinclair's The Jungle about the meatpacking industry, written a long time ago, or the more recent work of Michael Pollan, which suggests we can shed our expectations for instant meat and massive industrial farms with some kind of progressive ideas about nature.
I think I'm the only American kid who never read The Jungle in high school, so I actually had to sit down and read the darn thing. And what a snore that book is. I think I dispatched any mythology about the relationship between, say, meat inspection and Upton Sinclair. I think I handled that okay based on what I learned about him. His book, frankly, gets way too much credit for a lot of things. He just happened to be the guy in the right place at the right time, and he was convenient for the use of President Theodore Roosevelt. Michael Pollan's book is a different matter. Michael Pollan is a terrific writer, but Omnivore's Dilemma in particular grossly simplifies the difficulties of trying to feed an urban nation. It's real easy to blame corporations for every conceivable problem you can think of, and then to suggest, for example, that we should have small-scale local food sheds and small-scale livestock production on pasture. Those proposed solutions do nothing to address the underlying drivers or factors that led to this system in the first place. You're still going to have all those people living in cities who are going to want meat every conceivable way they can get it.
Is there too much of an emphasis on meat in our diets, do you think, to be sustainable with the populations that we're contemplating over the next 100 years?
Because I knew that I was going to get asked this question or something like it, my husband and I started keeping track of how much meat we eat on a regular basis. And it turns out that we eat about 50 pounds of meat a year. On average, Americans eat 227 pounds. I honestly can't figure out how anybody can eat that much meat. So I'm not going to tell anybody what they should do in their diet, but I, for the life of me, can't figure out how I could possibly squeeze, what, four times more meat into my diet. So, it might actually help if we weren't eating quite so much meat, but I guess people like eating a lot of meat.
But it's your view that there's a lot of slack in the system and that we could change things a lot without eliminating meat or without eliminating the efficiencies of agribusiness.
My personal opinion is, given the demand both in the United States and globally, I think that the system we have, despite all of its flaws, and I'll be the first to admit that I don't really want to live anywhere near a confinement operation. I just don't want to do it. I think given all of that, meat packers and farmers have actually figured out an extremely efficient way to supply all that meat while causing discomfort to a minimal amount of people. Now, I know that sounds somewhat heartless, but packers and farmers have systematically pushed livestock production and slaughter and processing into smaller and smaller geographical areas so that they affect fewer and fewer people. They have mechanized the heck out of slaughter. I keep telling people that if we could go back in time 100 years, 120 years, and walk down, say, the streets of Manhattan, where you are now, or the streets here in Iowa, where I'm sitting, there would be slaughterhouses all over the place. It would not be pleasant. I don't know about you. I really, really kind of like how clean the city is where I live, and I like not having to smell farms all the time, and the vast majority of Americans don't. So there are lots of trade-offs. It's just way too complicated to say, man, big ag and big food caused all these problems. Let's just get rid of them.
Maureen Ogle, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Don. I really appreciate it.
Maureen Ogle is the author of In Meat We Trust, An Unexpected History of Carnivore America. Speaking of food, 47 million Americans on food stamps, many of them meat eaters. Your conversation is about how important that program is and others to you. We've had EBT for 2 years in Florida, one of you writes, because the economy was so bad there. However, things are going great, getting better. We will be off them soon, but couldn't have made this transition without them. We're very grateful and fortunate. Your story is about food and keeping the family fed at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Al Jazeera America, presenting live up-to-the-minute coverage of the day's events at 8 and 11 p.m. Eastern, followed by the investigative series America Tonight. Channel information for Al Jazeera America available in local listings and at aljazeera.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments across the country.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.